From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm producer Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in 1928 during a contentious meeting at Paramount in Los Angeles. A silent film actress known as a flirtatious flapper, both on and off screen, was denied a raise. Instead of storming out or making demands, she calmly quit on the spot and sailed off to Europe to make a film with a director she had never heard of in a country whose language she didn't speak. It was a decision that would change her life, for better or worse. I'm talking about Louise Brooks, born in Kansas, trained in New York, discarded by Hollywood, and embraced by Rochester. She was known both as one of the best and the worst actresses of all time, depending on who you ask. But she was indisputably the most honest. She was ahead of her time, both in the natural way she performed and in her desire to be independent and control her own life. She didn't play the Hollywood game. She said, "I have a gift for enraging people. If I ever bore you, it will be with a knife." She came to Rochester in the mid-1950s, but throughout her life, she came to be compared to the most famous character that she played. It was Lulu in Pandora's Box. Lulu was described as perverse, childlike, naive, playful, and sensual. An exterminating angel, a murderess, a monster. Louise left Hollywood forever in her 30s, and she ran away from everything and wound up living a hand-to-mouth existence as an escort who loved her gin. Fast forward to 1955 when James Card, former curator of the George Eastman Museum here in Rochester, rescued Louise from obscurity and brought her here to town. Then began her resurrection, both as a beloved actress and now also as a talented writer. F. Scott Fitzgerald once said there are no second acts, but he was wrong about Louise Brooks. A new documentary will tell the story of Louise's life in Rochester. We'll devote the hour to talking about that, about Louise's connections to the George Eastman Museum, and, of course, about her films. I couldn't be joined by a more perfect panel with me today. Longtime film critic Jack Garner, who knew Louise personally. Welcome, Jack, to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Thomas Gwadish is the director of the Louise Brooks Society, and I was just told he is doing the new audio commentary for the new release DVD and Blu-ray of Diary of a Lost Girl, one of Louise's films.
Good to be here.
Thank you for coming in. And Charlotte Siller is a student at SUNY Purchase and a writer, researcher, and filmmaker who is working on a screenplay and a documentary about Louise Brooks. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by saying, we were talking about this briefly before the show, when you say the name Louise Brooks, people either react very strongly, oh my goodness, I can't believe that you brought that up, I love her, or they look at you with a blank stare. And I turn to you, Jack. What should people know about Louise if they don't know who she is?
Well, it's clear why they wouldn't know who she is because, well, first of all, our society increasingly gets farther and farther away from the world of silent film. And in sound film, she has virtually no reputation. She made a couple films, but nothing worth writing home about. But the silent films were very, very important. And what they should know about Louise is that she was, a lot of people credit her with being the first truly natural silent film actress, or actor, actually. And by that I mean that she never, there was a sense of drama that actors would sometimes bring that were a little over the top by today's standards. And again, that's also a little overplayed because there's some other great actors over the years, Lillian Gish and Douglas Fairbanks had his moments or whoever. But Louise had this sort of quiet, gentle sensuality that she, well, gentle is maybe not the right word, but a restrained sensuality and a really interesting quality. And she was also incredibly stunning looking, and she pioneered that idea, that black helmet hairdo, as they call it, that the sort of the flapper look. She and Colleen Moore, it's been argued, who did more inspiring, but they both did. And so anyway, she made these great German films. But she also was, the way I always describe Louise, is a person who burned every bridge she ever walked over.
Right.
You know, she just didn't care about any of the normal stuff that people are supposed to care about. And she was upset. And when silent films became sound, there was a trick that the studios did. They used it as an excuse to lock in people for 7-year contracts and to make their wages less than they were before the sound came in, which is ironic because they should be paying them more because they're doing more. But they would do these things, and Louise wouldn't put up with it. And they wanted her to do the voices for the Canary murder case. She refused. And in fact, I think she was already en route to Germany or maybe already there, and she just would not come home to do that. Now, here's another interesting thing about Louise that also says something about her. She was dating a guy named George Marshall then,
right,
who eventually became the owner of the Washington Redskins. He had a big laundromat, early laundry business that made a lot of money. And she and George were having this affair, and they wanted to escape prying eyes. I suspect maybe George did more than her. I don't think she cared. But George wanted to escape, you know, the prying eyes. And in those days, before the global village, you could go to Europe and escape prying eyes. So they went to Europe for that reason primarily. And, oh, by the way, I think I'll make a masterpiece. You know, it was that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But anyway, Louise eventually came here, and then she was rediscovered. The people who are most credited with rediscovery is James Card, the Rochester archivist, who loved her as a young man. She was his cinematic lust. We all have them. Mine was Sophia Loren. Whatever, you know. But anyway, I was a little younger than James Card. But anyway, he loved her. John Springer knew of her, and we can tell that story when you want to tell it about how the discovery happened. But the other important figure was a guy named Kenneth Tynan, very famous British writer, who always also loved her and found out about her being up here in Rochester and traveled up here to see her. And they developed a very strong relationship, which is presumed platonic at that age because of the ages they were and all that. But still, they really seemed to really love each other and really get off. And he wrote this amazing essay, piece, one of the great magazine essays. The New Yorker published it. And when The New Yorker published it, it was the first time in the whole history of that magazine that they ran a photograph. Those of us of a certain age maybe remember The New Yorker never ran a photograph. They always ran sketches and little cartoons and little sketches. But they had Louise Brooks had to have a photograph.
Absolutely.
So they ran a photograph of Louise, and it broke the precedent at The New Yorker. And that piece brought her, you know, kicked off this whole revival and that we are still experiencing in varying degrees.
And that piece, correct me if I'm wrong, is included in one of the versions of Lulu in Hollywood, the book that she wrote?
In the revised version.
In the revised version.
That came out from the University of Minnesota Press.
Okay. Listeners, if you are in Rochester and you want to read that book, it's available at the Rochester Public Library, as are other books about Louise, and we'll talk about those later in the program. But turning to Thomas now, this is the 20th anniversary of the Louise Brooks Society.
Correct.
Tell me how you first discovered Louise yourself.
It was a little more than 20 years ago. I went to the video store to rent videos. This is the way one saw movies 20 years ago. And I didn't find anything among the new releases that I really wanted to see, so I ventured over to the classic shelves and noticed a video called Pandora's Box. I had never heard of the film or of the actress, but she looked pretty darn good to me on the cover. And there was something, some kind of blurb on the box that said something like, one of the most erotic films of all time. So I thought, yeah, this sounds pretty good for Friday night. So, you know, so I took it home and watched it, and I was just blown away. I just had never seen anything like it, and I got up the next morning and did something I don't think I've ever done before, but I watched the film all over again because I really had to, in a way, come to terms with what I had seen, just to try to understand Louise Brooks, who, after 20 years, I don't know that I really understand her all that much better. But so I watched that movie, and then I set off on a quest to watch other films of hers and to find out anything I could. And I found the superb biography by Barry Paris. And, you know, all the footnotes and all the work he put into that great book led me down other paths to explore as much as I could get a hold of. And again, this was all in the day when it was much more difficult to get hold of silent films, of scarce things. But I did what I could, and here we are 20 years later.
So going back to Barry Paris for a moment, that biography is incredible. And he's written books on Greta Garbo, Audrey Hepburn. And there's a story. He was signing books. I think it was the Audrey Hepburn book. He was signing those books. And someone came up. Charlotte's nodding her head.
Yeah.
Someone came up with the Louise book. And Barry Paris said, oh, Louise. He just loved writing about her because there was so much to write about. And Audrey Hepburn was this elegant spirit, this angel of a person. And then you have Louise on the other end of the spectrum, who was demonic in some of the things that she played in films and how she acted in life. So I always liked hearing about that story.
The demonic thing I'd take a little bit of an issue with. By that I mean she was very sexual, and she did all these things and burned bridges behind her and all that other stuff. But she did it with a kind of a weird sort of an intellectual, first of all, a burn up the world intellect. I mean, she was smart.
Absolutely.
Plus, she did it with a kind of a strange innocent, like, why not do this? Do you know what I mean? She wasn't nefarious, is what I'm trying to say. So that's where I would draw the line a little bit, because she never was really nefarious. She was just really smart and really, you know, wanted what was right by her standards of what was right, and in her film she could be pretty darn strong, that's for sure.
She I think she was also a rule breaker, you know. One of the reasons I live in San Francisco, but I'm here in Rochester, and the reason I came was to read her notebooks, which the George Eastman Museum inherited from her. And one of the things that the sense I got is that she would throw rules out the door when she didn't want to observe them, or they didn't, you know, serve her purpose or whatever. So I think she was a rule breaker, you know. She didn't care what other people thought of her at times.
But you say that, but on the other hand, there was a point when she first wrote her, started writing her memoirs, that she couldn't see them ever being published because, as she said, I could never unbuckle the Bible belt. So despite her rebellious nature, she also had a part of her that was still a little bit painted into a corner by the way she was brought up.
Mm-hmm.
The childhood she had, the fact that, by the way, she had been raped by a neighbor.
Right.
The fact that that she had, you know, a really interesting and sometimes troubling upbringing, but then she gets on Broadway when she's still a teenager. So, I don't know. I'm sort of rambling on here now. I'm sorry, but anyway, I just think that she, she was a rebel and a rule breaker, but she also sometimes had to be careful about some things, and she knew it.
If I may, I would just say that I think all of that really has to do with her just being a woman way ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas back then, demonic might have counted in the 20s and 30s with the things that she was doing. But now it would just make her a very bright woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, being a rebel, I think, was even more just her being way ahead of the rest of them.
Do you think she was a woman who wanted to be a woman on her own terms?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say so.
Charlotte, I know you came upon Louise accidentally. You sent me an email about how you discovered her.
Yeah.
I love that story. Can you tell that for our listeners?
So I was in Argosy Bookshop, which is this real treasure on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And they had a basement just full of film books. And I was having a pretty rough day. And I went down there because it's, you know, heaven for me. And Lulu in Hollywood practically fell off of the top shelf and hit me in the head. which now I totally get that. Now that makes a ton of sense, now that I know who it is. But it was one of those things where I had never been a big fan of hers, and I'd looked at the book but refused to read it, and it just fell in love with her writing the moment that it finally threw itself into my hands.
But you were familiar with her before the book fell on your head?
Yes, I had heard a few things about her in acting school.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I forgot you have the acting school background. That's one place they would have talked about her a little bit.
Yeah, a bit.
I was taking a class, and we were writing comedy sketches about flappers. This is how I discovered Louise. And I took a book out from the library, and she was mentioned as an afterthought in the back of the book, and there was a picture of her grave, and it said she's buried in Rochester, New York. And I thought, oh, my goodness. So I started doing some research. It turns out she's buried right next to my grandfather, which is... I was shocked. I've been around it so many times, but it says Mary Brooks on her grave, I think, doesn't it?
Maybe.
So I never made the connection. But it seems
Mary Louise Brooks.
Mary Louise. Right? Oh, okay.
But I think it says Louise on it.
Does it? Okay.
No, I'm not sure.
But I never really became aware of her until it just jumped out at me like it did for all of you. If you're just joining us, we're talking about silent film star Louise Brooks, who spent the last 20 or so years in Rochester, the last 20-ish years of her life, writing and doing research at the Eastman Museum. We'll talk about that Rochester connection some more in a bit. But right now, I'd like to talk about everything leading up to Rochester. So she was raised in Kansas. She wanted to be a dancer. Thomas, take us through a little bit of the biography, please.
She was born in Cherryvale, Kansas, grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and ever since she was a teen or preteen, she was very interested in dance. One thing I just read in her notebooks was a little list of the dance performances that her mother took her to. When she was 12 years old, her mother took her to see the Dennis Shawn Dance Company, which was founded by Ruth St. Denis and Ted Shawn. And they were the leading modern American dance company. And when she was 12, her mother took her to see Dennis Shawn in Kansas City. So that was quite a big outing. And I know that she herself, when she was a teen, she organized a group of other young people to go see Anna Pavlova dance in Kansas. And then she saw Dennis Shawn return when they came to Wichita, which is where she was. And in one of those, in 1922 or maybe 1921, she went to go see Dennis Shawn, and her mother took her backstage after the performance and had her dance for Ted Shawn. And Ted Shawn told her mother to send her to Dennis Shawn in New York City. And so at the age of 15, she went to New York City to join this dance company. And that part of her life was just novelized in a best-selling book called The Chaperone.
Yes, The Chaperone.
Yes, by Laura Moriarty. So she joined Dennis Shawn, and she was with that company for 2 years. They toured all over the United States. Amongst the other dancers in the company, the first year she was with them was Martha Graham. After she got kicked out of Dennis Shawn, or sort of expelled.
But before she gets kicked out, though, Dennis Shawn did come here, too. I mean, this is one of her stops.
Yes. They danced in Rochester twice. Touring all over the country as far out as Colorado and Texas, and north into Canada, you know, Montreal, Toronto. And then after Dennis Shawn, she was expelled for having a superior attitude.
Surprise.
And then she floated around, got a little dancing work with the George White Scandals, and then quit them on a lark, went to London and danced at the Café de Paris, which is now a famous London nightclub. It was recently opened then. This is 1924. She was the first person to dance the Charleston in London. And then she comes back to the States and still needs to find work, so she joins the Ziegfeld Follies, and she's with them for maybe about a year, a couple different shows.
At which point she also developed a very strong friendship with W.C. Fields, one of her favorite people.
Yes. Has a brief affair with Charlie Chaplin. By getting noticed in the Follies, she is launched into film. And Paramount had their studios in New York City area then, and she got a contract, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. Charlotte, tell us about how she was noticed by G.W. Pabst, who directed her most famous film, Pandora's Box.
Well, G.W. Pabst had seen a film by Howard Hawks called A Girl in Every Port, and he sort of had been on this major hunt for his Lulu for the Wedekind play, which in Germany, that's like They're Gone with the Wind. And it was actually a pretty big stink that he chose an American girl that made a lot of people very angry. But he was so sure that this was who he wanted. And at the moment that Louise quit her contract, they finally let her know that he had been trying to get in touch with her. And then from there, he was about to sign Marlene Dietrich, and she called and let him know. And that's how it happened. It's, you know, and then that's all history. She hops on a boat with George Marshall. They tried to get her back to do a musical version of Dixie Dugan, I believe it was, on stage. And George Marshall did not even show her the note, just crumpled it and threw it in the garbage and figured, well, she's not going back there. And I mean, made her
and the Canberra, and the Canberra, then they want her back for the Canary, the Canary
Murder Case. Yeah,
I think that might have been later, though. Was it not?
It was during the filming of Pandora's Box, or just after.
Right. Louise told me herself that she's so glad that she actually got to play Pandora's Box for a lot of reasons, but one reason is that Marlene Dietrich would have been awful.
Right.
And she's right. Because Marlene Dietrich was more obvious. That's the thing about Louise is that she was mysterious and also had this sort of weird innocence despite all the sexuality going on. And Marlene Dietrich would have been much more obviously you know, a sexual figure, and it just wouldn't have had that mystery about it. So as great as Marlene Dietrich certainly was, she would have been wrong for Pandora's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So let's talk about Pandora's Box for a second. Let's talk about the character of Lulu. It's based on the character in the play, which I think was based on Salome. Is that correct?
It came from the Pandora's Box movie was based on a play by Frank Wedekind, German mm-hmm. playwright. And the Lulu character is many things. Perhaps you could call her a femme fatale, but she doesn't really fit the classic mode of or model of a femme fatale. She has this innocent sexuality about her. Mm-hmm. And all the guys that are attracted to her and even the women all end up in a bad state. Let's put it that way.
But it's not her intention.
Right.
She's so oblivious.
She is oblivious.
She just sort of takes the attention as it comes to her.
Mm-hmm.
Also, by the way, they have made an opera of Lulu.
Yes.
And it's currently in New York right now.
I was told by my colleague here that it's being shown again tomorrow here locally. We'll have to look into that, and I'll post it on the podcast page if it is. But it was shown once, I think, at the Dryden?
I think it was the Tinseltown Theater.
At Tinseltown,
actually.
Thank you. And it may be shown again, so if you're interested, we'll post that on the podcast page.
It's one of those live opera on screen kind of things?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
One interesting bit about the current staging of the opera in New York City is that the artist who is responsible for the staging, William Kentridge, is himself a big Louise Brooks fan, as he stated in the New York Times. And he just donated a big archive of his moving picture work to the George Eastman Museum. He's a multimedia type artist, though he's really, I suppose, best known for his drawings and paintings. The other thing I'll mention about the Lulu opera and the movie and then the plays, the source material, there really is a direct link, because when Alban Berg was composing the Lulu opera, he had saw Pandora's Box, the movie. He was composing it right about 1929. And later into the early 30s. And I once came across a letter that Berg had written to Theodore Adorno, the critic, in which Adorno mentions seeing recently, then, 1933, I think, seeing Pandora's Box at a theater in Germany. So the movie had circulation, and it also had that kind of influence on the opera itself, which one thinks of as a separate work.
So. Mm-hmm. So speaking about Louise and the character of Lulu, Pabst knew that she was the perfect Lulu, and he compared her in real life to this character. We've got a cut that we'd like to play about Louise reacting to that statement.
The funny thing about Lulu was this. He knew instinctively that I was Lulu, and that was fine in the picture. Mm-hmm. Making the movie was perfect. He just turned me loose and I'd be all right. But off the set, he wanted me to be an intelligent woman, a well-disciplined actress, and I wasn't. He was taking drinks out of my hand, seeing that I was kept in my room, and he was furious because he approached people intellectually. And you couldn't approach me intellectually because there was nothing to approach. So he was always a little bit mad at me.
At the same time, he was aware that you were a Lulu.
Oh, absolutely. But he didn't like it.
That was Richard Leacock conducting that interview. And I'm looking at Jack. You're shaking your head. Tell me what you're
thinking. She's being, what's the word, disingenuous or whatever when she says she's not intellectual. She was very famous for reading seriously heavy books on the set of a movie when somebody else would rather just, you know, screw around. And so she was an intellectual. And I mean, One of my favorite things I ever saw in Lulu's apartment, or Lulu, Louise Brooks' apartment over at 7 North Goodman, which is where she lived, was a copy of Proust, mm-hmm. Remembrance of Things Past. All 6 books, every one of them annotated on every page. This is a woman who was intellectual. So that's why I say she's being a little disingenuous in that quote. I'll tell you a funny and interesting story I've always loved. When there's a scene in this thing where she comes out of a bath, and she has on this white terry cloth robe.
Mm-hmm.
And when she first filmed the scene, Pabst stopped him and said, "Now, Louise, do you have on underwear under that robe?" And she says, "Yes, I do." And she says, and he says, "Go take it off." And she says, "Well, why am I going to take it off? Nobody's going to see it, and nobody's going to know." And then that scene, she hugs this guy, Francis Lederer, and so when she says, "Well, who's going to know?" Pabst says, he's going to know.
Mm-hmm. And that was the genius of Pabst. And there are other examples of Charlotte, if you want to jump in.
He was brilliant. And he really, and she's the first person to say it, he was so aware of how to reach people psychologically in a way that many directors were unable. And I think that's how he caught some of the really beautiful moments that he does throughout all of his films. So,
yeah, in fact, there's a bit of a mistake that we may be sort of falling a little bit into in that assuming that Louise was kind of a one-trick pony, because she has three or four really, really worthwhile films that should be seen. The following Pandora's Box was Diary of a Lost Girl, and that if she didn't make Pandora's Diary, we'd be sitting around talking about that as a masterpiece.
That's true.
Because it's really just about as good. And then she made a great French film with an Italian filmmaker, Giannini, called The Beauty Prize, or the and it's
Prix de Beauté.
Prix de Beauté. And it's fabulous, and a little warning here, if you're going to see it someday, I'm going to give something away. She has one of the great death scenes of all time in that movie. And then there's a couple of the American films. Beggars of Life is a very good film.
Yes, yes.
And so there's stuff to look out and try to find.
Yeah, I think she is too often seen as a one film actress. I think, you know, her European films are all very, very good. And Beggars of Life, The Show Off, is also, I think, a really good film.
Mm-hmm.
Not a masterpiece, but maybe a minor masterpiece. It's a fine little work. And things like Love 'Em and Leave 'Em and It's the Old Army Game with W.C. Fields are a lot of fun.
And although it's not a great film, another film that's just interesting to see because of its backstory is Overland Stage Raiders, which is her last film, because it was one of the first films for John Wayne, who she loved. I don't know whether that, I don't mean that, I don't know if it was literal or not, but I probably was, knowing Louise. So it's fun to watch that, just to watch Louise Brooks with John Wayne. That's a combination you wouldn't find every day.
Mm-hmm. So Pandora's Box, Diary of a Lost Girl, and Prix de Beauté, those are relatively easy to find, I want to say. I know they're available at the Rochester Public Library. For those other films, where can people find those if they'd like to see them?
A couple of them have come out on DVD on major labels. The Show Off is out there.
Beggars of Life has been there's a series, I call them the pink movies because they have a pink cover on. There's a series of like three volumes of which have two movies each. So there's like six movies of hers that have become available, and you can get them on DVD.
Right.
They're not necessarily pristine quality by any stretch, but at least you can see the films.
They're sort of budget releases,
right?
Not the best of quality, but sometimes that's all you can get.
And you get them on Amazon or any of the usual sites, usual suspects. Plus, didn't you tell me, Thomas, that they're about to release a Beggars of Life in a good quality one?
There's talk. The Eastman Museum has the best surviving quality of Beggars of Life.
So that would be fun to see. By the way, I would recommend also that people keep their eye on the Eastman site, because Eastman will quite often circle around and show various Louise Brooks films. And I try to alert people when I find out about it.
And if I could just put in a shameless plug for the Eastman Museum, they have an amazing collection of her things in their archives, especially their paper archives, and also for other stars. And they've really done such a good job of preserving these artifacts, and it seems like very few people know about it. But really, if you wanted to learn more about her, probably the best place to go would be to look at her writing. And they have so much of that there in her journals and in her planners. And even if you just read Lulu in Hollywood, there's a lot to be gained from her words.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk all about that, her writing and more. We're late for a break. Before we get to that break, I'd just like to say, if you have questions for our panel, feel free to call. Our number here, it's 454-6300 or 800-295-9994. You can also find us on Twitter. You can find me at MMacMedia. Send us your tweets. We'll read them on the air. Right now, Horace is reacting to a Louise picture that I posted earlier. He says, so glamorous. And Rock Brainery, the Rochester Brainery, is saying, loving this hour, learning so much about Louise. We will be right back with more on Louise Brooks right after this short break.
I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, East High has a new partnership between the University of Rochester and the Rochester City School District. Will it work? What about teachers? How is it working so far? And is this the kind of model that can travel to other Rochester schools? Then second hour, raising children from a theistic versus an atheistic perspective. We'll have a conversation about that. Talk with you Thursday.
Sarah? Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Renova Solar, serving upstate New York with the design and installation of solar power systems for home and business. More information at renovasolar.com.
And we are back talking about silent film star Louise Brooks. I want to repeat those phone numbers that I said earlier. Our lovely audio engineer, Val, has corrected me. Thank you, Val. If you would like to call the program, it's 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994 and 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. So let's jump back into Louise. And everything's going well in Europe. Pandora's Box is released. Not a huge success. Not a success in the U.S., but Louise stays on. She makes Diary of a Lost Girl. She makes the French film with the Italian director, and then she decides to come back to America. Pap said, I really want you to stay in Europe. I want to make you an international film star bigger than Garbo, but Louise is homesick, and she comes home.
And he cautions her that unless you get your act together, you too will end up like Lulu, which is not a good ending.
Not at all. And so back in the U.S., things are not going so well at Paramount because she decides she doesn't want to redub the Canary Murder case. And to fast forward a little bit, she decides to leave Hollywood. What happens after that?
Well, this is actually the area that I've been studying most particularly. So she goes back to Kansas. Sort of flees from Hollywood because somebody warns her that if she remains there any longer, she's going to turn into a call girl. So this is sort of all she needs to hear. And she's had enough of it anyway, didn't like it from day one. And at this point, she goes home to Wichita and starts a dance studio. And this is sort of a very tumultuous time in her life. She's trying very hard to make up for what she's done. She was very much a mother-propelled star. So going home a failure in that respect did not go over too well, but she spent a lot of time, as she says it, sort of in, you know, scrubbing floors and trying to make up for what she's done. And it's a very strenuous 4 or 5 years of just continuous downfall, and then eventually she can't take that anymore. She gets arrested a few times for some lascivious behavior in a blue law state and flees back to New York, where she takes a job as a shop girl for a while. And it's rumored that there may have been a short stint in the call girl industry. However, there isn't a lot of basis to that, so it gets a little shady.
Her store was Saks Fifth Avenue, by the way. She worked at Saks Fifth Avenue for a while.
Yes.
And then, there was a brief time in Chicago in between there, right?
With Deering Davis.
Oh, yes, right. There's that, yeah. Too.
Early 30s.
She was married twice. She had her first marriage, which was happy for a little while, I think, but ultimately didn't work out. It was with a really fine director of the period named Eddie Sutherland in Hollywood.
Right.
There's some pretty funny comments for that one. Yeah. if you can find any of his comments on that marriage, I recommend reading them.
He found her difficult to deal with, or what?
He said that she drove him to the psychiatrist's couch because he could not keep up with her appetite.
There you go.
There we go.
So, among other things, that was a cover.
It sounds like it's the opposite of the Tim Tebow case that just came out, where he's getting divorced because of lack of sex. I have a feeling that wasn't the same thing there. But anyway, and then she went to Chicago and married another guy.
Right. She married a fellow named Deering Davis, who is a Chicago playboy, and they formed a dance team for a short time. And she did ballroom dancing, like you see on TV these days.
Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, dancing in Chicago. And when they split up, she hooked up with another professional dancer and toured the country doing dancing in New York, Detroit, Chicago, Miami, Florida, wherever. Mm-hmm. And that's what she could do to make a living because she was sort of broke.
The reviews were good, too.
Yeah.
She was a very talented dancer. I think that, though, that early getting booted out of school sort of held her back in that respect.
Mm-hmm. In fact, she always said that if she had her druthers, all the different things she did do in her life, her favorite would have been to have been a dancer with Martha Graham.
Yeah.
She wanted to go and dance with Martha Graham at some point in her life and it never came to fruition. I've always maintained in her later years that she also proved that maybe her best profession, because of her isolated nature, would have been to be a writer. She was a really good writer, and she mm-hmm. and she spent those years of reclusism, if that a word, I don't know, doing a lot of, you know, doing that great writing that she did. She's a beautiful writer.
Also, in that reclusive period in New York, she did write her autobiography and then claims that she threw it down the incinerator. Yeah, mm-hmm. said it was good practice. Okay.
That's where the quote came in about, I can't unbuckle the Bible belt. That's one reason she threw it down the incinerator.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And she hung out for a while in a bar under the 59th Street Bridge, I think, for a while. Somewhere that area. Yeah.
We'll get to your calls very shortly. Cheryl is waiting patiently on the line. We will get to you soon, Cheryl. I just want to talk about how she came to Rochester first, how Louise was discovered in New York by James Card. There's a funny story that we've been talking about off the air. Jack, take it away.
Well, John Springer was a Rochesterian who went on to become a world-class publicist for Hollywood and Broadway people, lived in New York, and in fact, he represented Liz Taylor and Richard Burton during the whole Cleopatra affair. He also represented Marilyn Monroe at the time of her funeral, so this was a very busy publicist. And so he lived in New York and written a couple books called They Had Faces Then, from the Gloria Swanson's quote, because he had, they were picture books about famous old Hollywood people. So he knew his stuff. James Card was the curator here. He'd been a curator since 1948. He goes down there in the mid-50s to see his friend John Springer. They hang out for a little while in John's apartment over on the Far East Side. And apparently Card says to Springer one day, do you have any idea whatever happened to Louise Brooks? Because Louise Brooks, as I said, Card's big thing was German film, and his biggest thing was Pabst and Louise Brooks.
And this was, let me interrupt you, this was at a time when Louise Brooks had fallen into two or three decades of obscurity. Nobody remembered her anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Those two guys were probably the only two guys in New York who even knew they were talking about her, and they would know who that is, maybe. Anyway, he says, do you have any idea what happened to Louise Brooks? And Springer started to laugh. He says, she lives in this building right down the hall. So they go knocking on Louise's door. And eventually Card says, why don't you come up to Rochester? And in Rochester, you can see your films at the Eastman House. We have the greatest collection of your films. And you can write about them, do some research and write. And she came up here and got an apartment at 7 North Goodman, a small little Pullman apartment. And she would write. And she did a little bit of radio, talking, you know, commentary about films. She spent a lot of time at the library. In fact, she dedicated Lulu in Hollywood to the librarian who helped her most. That's who the name is in the beginning of the book.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so it's funny, of all the men she met in her life, she dedicates it to her librarian. But anyway, she stayed here, and then I got to know her quite late. I mean, she was already been quite ill. She had emphysema near the end, and she had oxygen in her room but refused to use it because she was absolutely convinced it was going to blow up. But she came here because Card asked her to come, showed some attention. She got some attention. She was thrilled to get some attention. She comes here. It's a quiet life, although she writes for Hyde, again, showing her intellect. She's not writing for crap here. She's writing for Sight and Sound and Film Comment and really high-end film magazines. And she's writing really good articles. And so those were eventually became collected, along with a couple of new pieces, into the Lulu in Hollywood book. But she wrote those. And then Tynan finds out about her. Tynan comes here, and Louise Brooks part two occurs, part two mm-hmm. of stardom.
Let's get to the phones. We have Cheryl in Lindville waiting for us. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I was listening to the story on my way to Wegmans, and here I sit in the parking lot still listening to you. And I just remember growing up on Rundell Park, which is two blocks over from Goodman Street, and we used to watch Louise Brooks walk to the store with her big paper bags. And, the adults would say, leave her alone, she's a famous star, And this, I believe, must have been the late 60s. I moved to Rundell Park as a kid in 65. We moved out of there in about 78. I'm believing it must have been the late 60s she was there.
Well, that'd be about right. She was there actually from the late 50s. But that would have been about the period that she could be walking to the store. By the time I got to know her, going out of the apartment was not something she did hardly ever.
There was a Rochester newspaper columnist, Henry Clune, who kept her name in the local papers at least.
Clune is a great guy, by the way, and if you ever want to read any stuff about Rochester, his books are definitive. Henry Clune was great. But I did know, he did know Louise. Mm-hmm.
going back to the relationship with James Card, this is always something I was very curious about. Maybe you can tell me the answer to this question. So in the beginning of the book, letters, or Dear Stinkpot, letters from Louise Brooks, everything is Jimmy this, Jimmy that. She loved James Card. And then things change toward the end. And there's a quote that I want to read. This was written in October of 1960. After 5 years of having subjected myself to this, to his jerking malice and degradation and the confusion of a cesspool of lies, it is like diving into a clean, cool pool to be free of him. I cannot name a single good he has ever done me without the object of either explicating me or injuring me. What happened between them?
Well,
they had an up and down relationship.
Yes.
As Louise Brooks had with many people.
Yes.
Yeah, she was volatile and would go up and down a lot. Go ahead.
I don't think either of them were very easy to deal with. So that would be two very strong-willed, passionate people in one spot and working on the same things. And often I find it's hard to work with somebody that you're close with on anything, especially something like writing. However, there are 1,000 different stories about what happened there. I think it's clear that he did her some good just by bringing her here. Mm-hmm. And
Created the writer. She might have ended up writing anyway, but...
But he encouraged the writer, and sometimes that's all it takes to make great things happen, mm-hmm. is one person to say, you know, you could do this. I don't know.
There was a third person that I should say was probably somewhat involved in all this, too, and that was Card's wife. She was a strong-willed, strong person in her own right, and I think that she was a little... is the word jealous, maybe? And there could have been some complications there. It was a volatile relationship that started really strong. And like Tom says, most relationships that lasted long ended up being on the rocky shores.
Even with her brother, who she loved dearly, ended up breaking off their relationship by correspondence because I don't think she wanted
could handle losing him.
Yeah. Mm.
Your documentary, Charlotte, can you tell us a little bit about what we can expect in a few years? I know we're
in
the very,
very early
stages. That's okay.
The documentary was sort of a side project. I've been working on a screenplay for the past 3 years, recently finished it.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Very proud of myself. But the documentary, I was so lucky that I came here and fell into the arms of all of these very welcoming people that knew so much, including Jack, who was a huge help.
Thanks.
And you're welcome. Thank you. And I just thought, I can't not take advantage of this. I can't not get interviews. These things should be documented and should be out there for all of the other people that want to learn about her. And it's not often that you hear about her intellectual side in Rochester. As much as I would love to see more of it, there's a lot of, what a pretty actress. And this was just a way to sort of spread the word on what the actual woman was like. And with so many people there to help me, I was really so lucky, and I wasn't going to let that chance go.
So you have a screenplay that's for a narrative film.
Yes.
And then you have a documentary
that
you're planning, and you shot some footage, I know, because I'm in some of it.
Yeah, you're in a lot of it.
And so do you have any kind of, is it too far away to say when they may or may not surface?
I would say it's going to be a while.
Okay.
I am still a student, and I'm tackling that and a few internships. So it's as I can put it together and when I can get all of the interviews that I need. I'm actually awaiting a trip to Memphis to get some more things in regards to it, and I'd like to film that as well. So it's
Memphis.
Yes.
Do we know something, Thomas? I don't know.
Tom Graves is
okay.
A very wonderful man who spent some time here and wrote a very good book about Louise and the other people that he's spoken with over the years.
Gotcha.
So it's one big adventure, and I'm hoping I'm only a quarter of the way through it because I love it so much. I'd like it not to end.
There have been other plans over the years, but they've never sort of came to fruition of films. Yours will. I have every plan and hope that they will.
Oh.
But there was a film that Shirley MacLaine was interested in, of all people. The funny thing about Shirley MacLaine is that, and I've talked to her about it, so I know it's a true story. Shirley MacLaine, the funny thing is that when she was young, she didn't look at all like young Louise. As an older lady, she looked just like the old Louise. It's a bizarre thing that happens when people get old. Things change. And so the old Louise that I've known, there's not a whole lot of photos. There are a few. The gray-haired, long-haired mm-hmm. Louise. Shirley looked like her, and Shirley wanted to do a film based on the relationship between Shirley, between Louise and Kenneth Tynan, the writer that was a key point in their the revival of Louise. She wanted to make a film about that, and there would be some flashbacks. There was even talk at one point when she was younger of Julia Roberts perhaps getting involved.
I think she had the rights to the story at one point.
Right. So it would have been an interesting film, but it never saw the light of day. Louise has been, been a factor, a mention, or whatever you want to call it, an influence in various films. What was that movie with Madonna early in her career?
Desperately Seeking Susan.
Desperately Seeking Susan, where the character wears a Louise hairdo, kind of. And there have been a few other cases of the helmet hair showing up. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, so there's a good movie there. Hopefully you'll make one or two of them.
Or three or five
or whatever.
Whatever.
But it would be good to see something done. That project would have been interesting, the Shirley MacLaine. Mm-hmm. But it never came to fruition. I'm sure it's hard getting people's money for that.
Mm-hmm. We can watch her films. We can read about her in books. But, Jack, tell us what she was like to meet in person. Louise, on your own. No filter, Louise.
She was really interesting. I did meet her old. I mean, she was pretty old by the time I met her. You'd walk in her apartment. She never locked it. She'd rather get raped and beaten up than have to get up to answer the door. She just stayed in her bed. She had on like a bed jacket kind of thing that she wore over her. And she had a tray that would swing out that would have a radio on so she could listen to. She loved talk shows. She loved politics. She loved, not that, I never quite knew what her thinking was on politics, but she just liked to have the discussion going on, I guess.
Can I interrupt here briefly?
Yeah.
Going through her notebooks, which is this record of all the books that she read, the movies that she saw, the TV shows that she watched, and the radio that she listened to, there we found an entry for listening to WXXI.
Oh, hey. Okay.
In 1975.
Oh.
Very good. Please go on, Jack.
So anyway, I'd go in to see her, and I always tell people that my relationship with Louise was a double kind of relationship. On one hand, I'm a younger guy and my wife with me, and we are helping an old lady who needs help. So you run errands, you pick up stuff. With Thanksgiving, we always brought her turkey dinner, that kind of thing. On the other hand, the value for me, of course, was that in return for that, I'd get all these wonderful stories and I could just sit and talk. So I could go over there without a job, so to speak. I didn't always go there because I had something to do. I could just go there. And she would just talk, and we'd talk about all kinds of things. She also loved to kind of guess aspects of a person's sexuality. Hmm. Who's straight, who's gay, who cares. But she would just be interested in talking about that. She also loved to talk about dance, and she told me on one occasion, that John Travolta, in her mind, was a very good dancer. She had seen Saturday Night Fever, and she loved him in that film. And other than that, near the end when she got the beginning touches of senility, one night I got a call at like 1 a.m. or something, and she says, "Jack, you have to come over right away." And I said, "What's the problem, Louise?" And she says, "I had a paperclip on some things and I dropped it and it's under the bed. I have to get that paperclip. You have to come over and get it." Come on, what is that? But again, that just showed her state at that late stage in her life. But I love the time I spent with her. I love taking Louise Rainier over to meet her once when she was here. I also took Sylvia Sidney over to meet her. Sylvia was a very brash, outspoken lady, and Louise looked at me at one point and said, "Get her out of here." but it was a wonderful experience to get to know Louise. I can't deny it. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I'm jealous.
I know, I am too. What's next for the Louise Brooks Society, and where can people connect with you online?
Well, it's our 20th anniversary this year. We're online at www.pandorasbox.com. And
a Facebook page.
And we're on Facebook, Twitter, all the social media. I'm just working right now on rebuilding, revamping the website into, the web 2.0 or 3.0 or whatever we're up to. And I'm working on a new book, which is going to be focusing on the films of Louise Brooks. Back in the 60s and 70s, there was that series of books, The Films of So-and-So, and Louise Brooks deserves her turn. So that's what's next for me.
And Charlotte, you're working on your many, many projects. Mm-hmm. Can we follow you online? Are you
Not yet. Okay. I will let you know when you can, as soon as I have a website.
For our local listeners who want to check out Louise Brooks-related materials at the Eastman House, what can you recommend?
I would recommend going straight to the paper archives. That would be my first stop, and then I would start seeing the films.
Now, the average Joe can walk off the street and ask to see her diaries.
No, you would contact, you would make an appointment through Nancy Kaufman, who is the wonderful woman that runs them.
Okay.
And
as I said, keep watching their movie schedules. You should go to the Dryden a lot anyway, the Dryden Theater. But check their schedules on a regular basis, which you can do online, because they will have, they often show Louise Brooks films.
And they show silent films every Tuesday night. There, yes.
With Phil Carley, who's a fine piano player, playing along.
Oh, yes. We were talking about him earlier in the newsroom. That's great. Mm-hmm. We are almost out of time. Any last thoughts about Louise that you think our listeners should know about that we haven't covered yet?
Just find those films. I mean, Pandora's Box is a must-see essential film if you want to consider yourself a serious film goer. But beyond that, check out Diary and Prix de Beauté and Beggars of Life and anything you can, because she's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Oh, and read her book.
And check out all the other things that have been put out in homage to her. You know, the Chaperone is a fine novel. There is a book that came out earlier this year, a graphic novel called Louise Brooks Detective, which centers on her Kansas years. Natalie Merchant of 10,000 Maniacs put out a song about her just about a year or so ago. So there's a lot of resonance in our culture that, you know, is about her.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, the three of you, so, so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed this discussion. I hope our listeners did too. I want to thank Charlotte Siller, Jack Garner, and Thomas Squadish. Thank you all for coming in. We'll be following you, following Louise, to see what everyone's up to next. Valerie Labenka is the engineer of this program. Evan Dawson is your host. He will be back tomorrow. Thank you for listening to WXXI, your member-supported public radio station.